31. Bella stormed into the bunker, cycling through the many layers of security. Martin Hinks was on duty, supervising the scanning run. The cube turned within a loom of analysis instruments. Hinks, who had been born 10 years into the Fountainhead era, jolted awake at Bella's entry and tried to plaster on some vague simulacrum of alertness. "Go back to sleep, Martin," Bella said reassuringly. "It's all right." "Madam," he began. But Bella had already crossed the red line on the floor. An alarm sounded, warning her that she was in danger of impairing the scanning run. Bella shoved aside the robotic scanners, toppling one of them on its spindly tripod. The fragile equipment crunched to the floor. Hinks redoubled his protests. Bella ignored him. She reached out and touched one bare hand against the smooth black side of the cube. If asked, she could not have said exactly why she was doing this. All she knew was that the compulsion to touch the cube was now overwhelmingly strong, as if her entire life had been a vector aimed at this one moment, as if she had been born to touch the cube, and the cube had been born to embrace her touch. The moving surface was iron cold. Nothing happened. Her fingers tingled, but that was all. Bella pulled back, confused. Nothing had happened. She flexed her fingers. The old stiffness was creeping back in with each year, like an invisible glove that was beginning to harden in place. The alarm still blared. She looked back at Martin Hinks, expecting him to be angry that she had ruined the experiment, but instead he just looked embarrassed. "I'm sorry," Bella said. "I shouldn't have... I just wanted to know what it felt like." "It's all right, madam." "I'm sorry," she said again. Hinks left his desk and moved to the fallen machine, gently tipping it back into place. The white casing was badly dented where it had hit the floor, and Bella wondered idly whether it would ever work again. If they had not turned up the gravity in Crabtree, all would have been well. "It's okay," Hinks said. "I've touched it. We've all touched it. It's just something you have to do. Did I mess things up?" She caught the hesitation in his voice before he answered. Yes, she had. "No, no, we'd only just started this run. It won't take long to restart it. I've damaged the equipment." "It's fixable. It'll still work fine." The cube revolved again, and she saw the icy smudge where her fingertips had transferred a micro layer of grease and dead skin to the artifact's perfect black surface. She felt ashamed. "I'm sorry, Martin. I've ruined things." That was indefensible. Hinks helped her to a vacant stool, pushed back from one of the science consoles. "Can I bring you something to drink, perhaps, Madam Lind?" "I'm fine," she said. But even as she said it, she realized that she did not quite feel fine. She flexed her hand again. The fingertips were still tingling, as if the blood was just returning to them. She looked at the cube again. It was still turning, still oozing from one form to another. But the compulsion to touch it had disappeared. Her mind felt as clear as the dawn sky. Too clear, in fact, like a blackboard that had just been scrubbed. "Martin," she said calmly, "you need to do something for me. Call Ryan Axford or whoever is still on duty in the HAB and tell them they need to come and fetch me. Tell them I think the cube has injected something into me. And tell them to hurry." She slept, woke, slept again. Axford was always there, frowning over a hard copy readout, tapping keypad instructions into some reassuringly antique item of medical hardware, whispering quietly to one of the other medics. Visitors came and went, through the quiet hours of the early morning and into the day shift. Bella watched the wall clock lurch forward in spasms, then appear to stall for subjective hours. In fever, she knew, the processes of the mind ran at an accelerated rate, distorting the perception of time. Something like that was happening to her now, as the cube's machines spun havoc through her skull. It was clear now that the cube had pushed something into her. Its mass had decreased by 0.5 gram since she touched it. The day lulled into afternoon. Shifts changed, but Axford was always present. Once, when she came around and saw him looking askance at some display, she saw a weary old man packed into the shape of a boy. Afternoon bled into evening. Nurses came and gave her something to drink. It might have been to slake her thirst or to provide some isotopic tracer for the scans. They never offered her food, but she wasn't hungry. Now and then they fiddled with the lacy imaging coronet Axford had positioned over her hair, or nipped blood from her thumb, or ran some other inscrutable test whose function she couldn't guess. Later, in the small hours, she had another visitor. She felt more than usually alert. Normally she heard the hissing of the medical center's security doors, the exchange of words between visitor and duty staff, hushed confidences about her state of mind. There had been none of that this time. The visitor was simply there, standing by her bed. She was a woman, dressed in white. Bella saw only her face and hands. The rest of the woman's head was concealed under a kind of flat-topped wimple of the same electric white fabric as the rest of her gown. Her hands emerged from subtle folds, joined as if in prayer. Her skin was dark, her racial background otherwise indeterminate. Nordic bone structure, perhaps, or even Inuit. She was beautiful and severe, but there was a kindness and a wisdom in her face that touched Bella on some basal level of total trust. "Hello, Bella," the woman said. "You can see me now, can't you?" Bella found the energy to call out, "Ryan, please." She had not even been sure that Axford was still there. But he came, bustling over with a concern that cut through any fatigue he might have been feeling. "What is it?" "I'm hallucinating," Bella said calmly. "I'm hallucinating a woman dressed in white, standing immediately to your right." Axford looked guardedly to his side. "I'm not seeing anything, Bella. She's there, solid as daylight, looking at me." "Bella," the woman said with a searing empathy, "there's no cause for alarm." Axford adjusted the imaging coronet. He snapped glasses from his pocket and placed them on his nose. They were ridiculously oversized for a child. "There's a lot of activity in your occipitoparietal area and in the auditory cortex," he said, tapping a finger into midair to enlarge some detail of the scan. "I think the machines must be there. I think they're making me hallucinate." "Describe the woman," Axford said. "She's tall, black, dressed all in white, like a nun." Bella scowled at her own imprecision. "But she's not a nun. This isn't some stock religious imagery my mind's conjuring up during a moment of crisis." The woman looked on sympathetically, head tilted to one side, waiting for Bella to finish. "Do you recognize her?" "I can't see much of her, just her face. I'm not experiencing any heavy jolts of déjà vu." "Bella, listen to me," the woman said with infinite patience, infinite serenity. "You don't know me. You've never met me. It would have been difficult. I lived and died a long time after you left us." "She's talking to me, Ryan." Axford pulled the ungainly glasses from his nub of a nose. "Perhaps you'd best listen in that case. Bella, the short form of my name is Chromis Paskflower Bowerbird, but you can call me Chromis. The whole thing is a bit of a mouthful." "Hello, Chromis," Bella said, feeling awkward as Axford looked on, yet compelled to acknowledge the woman's presence. "You can understand me, right?" "Completely," Chromis said with a smile. "Do you mind if I ask who you are, and what you're doing in my head?" "Not at all. It would be rude of me not to explain myself after all. Well, to begin with, let's just say that I'm a politician of quite some seniority, what you might call a senator or a member of parliament. The political body I serve is, or was, at the last census at least, a grouping of worlds encompassing 15,000 settled solar systems, spread across a volume of space more than 4,000 light-years in diameter." Chromis extended a hand, showing Bella a ring she wore on her right index finger. It was embossed with an interlocking geometric design that squirmed and shifted somehow before Bella's eyes, teasing her with hints of dizzying complexity. "This is the seal of the Congress of the Lindblad Ring. That's the name of the political administration I serve." "You're a message from after the cutoff," Bella said. "I'm not sure what you mean by the cutoff, but I can tell you this much. You left Earth's system in 2057 by your calendar. The exact date at which I'm recording this image is unimportant. Suffice it to say that it's more than 18,000 years since your departure." Bella shook her head. "No. We've only come 260 light-years. A lot of time has passed, but it's only hundreds, not thousands of years." Chromis looked at her with that searing clemency. "There's no mistake, Bella. We know what happened to you at Spica. We know what happened during your passage through the Spica structure. We didn't pass through anything, Bella said, all the while knowing that it was pointless and infantile to argue with the woman's godlike wisdom. We reached the structure and now we're in it. You are somewhere, Chromis said, but it is definitely not within the Spica structure. How can you be so sure? Because we destroyed it. The woman looked rueful. It was the first glimpse of human fallibility Bella had seen in that gravely imperious face. It was not intentional. We were studying it, trying to understand the principles underlying its function. When? Bella asked. When did you destroy it? 17,000 years ago by my calendar, around the early 33rd century by yours. And when I say we destroyed it, I don't mean any extant power affiliated to the Congress of the Lindblad Ring. I'm simply referring to envoys of the human species, people from much nearer your own time. Bella's mind reeled, but she didn't have the slightest doubt that Chromis was speaking the truth. This is a lot to take in. I know, and I'm sorry. When you say we pass through, for 260 years, you were underway to the Spica binary at 99.9% of the speed of light. You experienced a time dilation factor of 22, which compressed that 260 years of flight into 12 years of subjective time, as measured by your clocks. It was 13 years, Bella said. No, if 13 years did indeed pass before your arrival here, it was because it took you 12 years to reach Spica, plus another year to reach somewhere else. I still don't. Chromis interrupted her gently. The Spica structure was a booster, Bella. Its purpose was to accelerate you even closer to the speed of light. A time dilation factor of 22, while high, was still insufficient for the long journey you eventually had to make. Chromis's serene face showed strain, as if imparting this information caused her genuine discomfort. To adapt an analogy from your own era, Bella, the first 260 light-years of your flight, that first 12 years of subjective time, was simply the process of taxiing to the runway. The Spica structure was the runway. Your journey had not really begun until then. Bella wanted to deny it, but the woman's conviction left no room for doubt. Chromis was telling the truth. So where did we go? She asked. Chromis looked abashed. We can't be sure, even now. By the time you passed through the structure, the nearest follow-on probes were still 100 light-years behind you. Their observations were made from a great distance. They detected faint signals from your free-flyer probes, enough to measure the change in your velocity as you completed your transit through the structure. But by the time you emerged, those signals had been lost. You couldn't see us anymore. No, the envelope was too dark, too absorbent. Bella supposed that she meant the iron sky. But you must have had some idea where we were headed. We had a rough idea. We extrapolated and located a counterpart to the Spica structure 2,000 light-years beyond Spica. Another booster, we presumed, or a course adjustment element. We knew you'd probably reach it in 2,000 years, but beyond that we had no means of tracking you or estimating your subsequent time dilation factor. You were too dark, too fast. We lost you. But you found us again, Bella said. We never forgot about you, Chromis said. The Janus anomaly changed history. The existence theorem says that it is always much easier to find a solution when you can be confident that one exists. Within 100 years of your departure, there had been cataclysmic breakthroughs in fundamental physics. Janus taught us to look for loopholes in the theories that had looked watertight for decades. Eventually, we had our own frame-shift drive. It wasn't as efficient as the Janus motor, and probably didn't employ anything like the same principles, but it sufficed. 18,000 years of expansion, Bella, at velocities very close to light speed. Frame shift made us a glorious human empire. The Congress of the Lindblad Ring is just one of the larger political entities in the great dominion of human space. I represent a small cluster of like-minded systems, about 130 worlds, bound together by long-established trade routes and a common democratic framework, what you might call a state or constituency within the Congress. There are hundreds of such constituencies, some of them very alien in their modes of society. Anyway, as I said, you were never really forgotten. We found your self-sacrifice inspirational. our self-sacrifice. Even when it became clear that you could not escape Janus, you kept sending data back home. But then you always promised as much. I did. The interview, Bella. Cromis said it with a peculiar reverence. You must remember. I'm not sure I do. Cromis's voice shifted, mimicking Bella's own. I'm Bella Lind and you're watching CNN. Bella blinked. CNN. You just said CNN. The interview was repeated many times during the years after you left, Bella. It became a touchstone for a kind of bravery, the noblest kind of selflessness. Children were taught to learn it, like a prayer or declaration of patriotic intent. I'm having trouble dealing with this. The Janus data changed history. It accelerated 100 different scientific disciplines, revealed connections no one had ever suspected before. Our knowledge of mass energy, mass and inertia, became logically complete. It gave us the stars, and for that we're enormously grateful. But at the same time, it was always taken for granted that your ultimate destination, your ultimate destiny, must remain unknown. The boosters were shuttling you into the future, out of our reach. Cromis smiled primly. Then we had a modest idea. It was approaching the 10,000th year since the first settlement of the First World in the Congress of the Lindblatt Ring. There were many competing ideas for the best way to commemorate this anniversary. My people sent me to table a proposal to the delegates on New Far Florence, and after a degree of persuasion it was accepted. We would commemorate the founding by sending a message to the benefactor. The benefactor being me, I suppose. Now perhaps you begin to see the importance you assumed to us. It would be a message of thanks, of course, but also a message that might be useful to the benefactor and her people, wherever they might find themselves. I am, self-evidently, that message. As the instigator of the project, my personality was encoded into the memorial cube you must have found. How did it reach us? Bella asked. How far did it travel to get here? I can't tell. We made vast numbers of cubes. Short of being dropped into a star, there isn't much that can harm them. We were thinking long-term, extreme deep time. Cromis anticipated Bella's next question. We scattered them to the four winds, dispersed them throughout the galaxy via automated probes, dropped them into orbit around 100 million dead worlds, cast them into intergalactic space on trajectories that would eventually bring them into the gravitational influence of every major galaxy, satellite galaxy, or globular cluster in the local group. We launched some of them far beyond the local group, towards the great galactic superclusters, halfway to the edge of the visible universe. They'll take a while to get there, of course. We even fired some of them into naked black holes, in the hope that their information would be encoded and released in the immeasurably distant future, when the black holes surrender their parcels of entropy back to the universe. We continued making them for 4,000 years. Of course, we never really expected success. It was just a gesture, the decent thing to do. But you succeeded, Bella said. One of them found me. Yes, it did. But there's no telling where or when. All I know is that this cube, the copy that this personality was dropped into, was one of the last to be launched. By then, the memorial project had already been underway for nearly 4,000 years, and in all that time, no contact had ever been claimed. Cromis meshed her fingers nervously. We can presume that you travelled a great distance, or we would have heard from you before the last cube was launched. But you can't tell me how far I've come. The cube only knows its subjective history. It has no record of how much objective time passed before you touched it. It may have been picked up and discarded 100 times, like a lucky coin. Even so, it was a long journey. Tell me everything up to that point, Bella said. In time, Cromis answered. All in good time.